Welcome to Child Custody in Jewish Law. I'm Mordechai Torchiner. I'm with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. We are I'll call it an educational resource in the sense that we are based in a high school called Yeshivat Or Chaim here in the community. We run programs for local university students, for the men at Or Chaim, and for the women at Ulpanat Orot, which is its sister school, all in the Clayton Park area here in the city. And then we also have educational programs around the community, including programs for professionals, including the program this evening for lawyers and others. You don't have to be a lawyer to be here. I'm not a lawyer. We are indeed approved for 1.5 professionalism credits for the program this evening. Please make sure that you signed in if you want those credits. Also, if you sign in, you will be on the email list for further legal ethics programs. We actually have another one coming up. That will be at the Bayit in Thornhill. It will be Sunday morning, December 4th, and the topic for that one is Shabbat and the Jewish lawyer. So issues of Jewish law that come up for someone who is observant of Jewish law and trying to serve clients at the same time, or potentially not at the same time, but that's the discussion. So that'll be Sunday morning, December 4th. Nothing that I say should be taken as legal advice. Nothing that I say should be taken as halachic counsel in the sense of telling a person this is what Jewish law says you must do. Each situation is unique, and we're going to see that a lot this evening. I'll ask that that you please silence cell phones, put them on vibrate, you know, something in order to make sure that that it doesn't distract. I'm grateful to the Roth family, for the extended Roth family, for dedicating the program this evening. That's Ellie and Judy Roth, Menachem and Itya Roth, Yaakov and Ariel Roth, and Yoni and Bailey Roth. Okay, the idea of coming up with a good system for managing custodial rights, such that when a couple separates, divorces, or when one member of a couple dies, the children are going to be taken care of in a good way, is extremely tricky. And I actually came across an article just the other day. You can see the link for it, number one on the source sheets, and you can see the date on it, November 17th. Right, today is what, the 21st. It was just the other day. Really, a painful article entitled "I Have to Text My Rapist: Victims Forced to Parent with Attackers." And this is a case in the U.S. There are several cases like it in which the rapist is actually, because they were convicted of one charge but not another charge, is actually entitled to custodial visits, to access to the child that who they fathered with this. And you can imagine the trauma that this involves for the mother of the child, that she has to coordinate visits, as the article details, has to talk to this person about how the kid is doing in school and health and everything else, and coordinate weekly times to actually bring the child there. It's horrific. And it points to the problem, in an extreme way, of coming up with a law that's actually going to work for all cases, and that's going to make sense, and that is going to serve the needs of the child in the best way possible. So we're not going to talk about that particular case this evening. What I want to do is speak to the sensitivities of the Jewish community in terms of custody issues. And this comes under the Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 3.2-1, which talks about being aware of and dealing with the sensitivities that particular clients have in their circumstances. So if you have clients from the observant Jewish community, they're going to have certain assumptions going in. In the event that you're trying to help couples to make their own parenting plan, this information becomes very relevant. If they're thinking about pursuing rabbinic help, it's clear that rabbinical courts cannot handle custodial issues here. However, they could be involved as counselors for parents who are trying to come up with a parenting plan. So if you have a client who says, "Yeah, I'm thinking about consulting a rabbi about this," the information that we're going to discuss, I think, will be very relevant in terms of understanding what they're likely to hear, and what types of values are going to be brought into this. Clearly, parents who are creating their own plan need to get legal and financial advice, not only in order to craft a good plan, but also because whatever they come up with their clergy, whatever they develop, is ultimately subject to review by the courts and potentially could be challenged and thrown out. Okay. Just out of curiosity, how many people here actually practice family law? Okay. So I know we have, and Yechiel was here and we'll be back. So yeah, so we have a few. So I'm going to be consulting you off and on in the course of the evening. Normally, those who have been at these classes before know that usually the sheets are about 60-40, 60% Jewish sources, about 40% secular sources about the law. But in this case, I packed everything with just the Jewish sources because there's so much to discuss in that way. But I'm going to ask about the secular as we go along. So you can see for yourself, if you take a quick look on the sheets, you'll see we're going to start out with the question of why Jewish law recognizes parental custody. What's the philosophy of it within Judaism? Because there are major practical ramifications to how you understand why a parent has custody of a child. Any parent has custody of a child. And then we move from that into a discussion of best interests of the child and the question of how rabbinical courts and how rabbis will look at the best interests of the child, how they evaluate what those best interests are, as well as what happens when certain Talmudic rules dictate that custody should be determined a certain way. However, best interests of the child seem to militate a different approach. We'll go from that into a discussion of the child's preference. Would a rabbinical court consider the voice of the child, and a child, either a child who is already older or a child who is actually a minor, will they take that into consideration? Will they consult psychologists? And then deal lastly with the issue of relocation of a custodial parent. What if one parent has the child living with them and they want to move somewhere else? From a Jewish perspective, what would we say? So those are the basic issues I want to deal with. For all the sources that have Hebrew and English, I brought you the Hebrew as well as the English, but I'm going to be reading out the English ones in the interests of time, and the Hebrew is there for those who have the skills to be able to read it in the original. So we start with the question of the philosophy of custody. The foundations for custody-specific rules in Jewish law are actually sparse, meaning when you look at other areas of law, let's say tort law, for example, or employment law, so there are all sorts of precedents you can find, biblical precedents for certain things, or certain basic rules that are given in the Torah that you can find in the biblical verses that will say, this is how we deal with this situation. So we have biblical verses that command in employment law that you have to pay somebody on the same day. We have all sorts of principles for dealing with disputes between employer and employee. When you deal with custody, there isn't really that much to go on. You don't find any biblical stories involving parents who divorced or widowing cases and disputes about how to handle the child. There isn't all that much to work with. We do have a few general laws, though, that are brought to bear on custody cases. So, for example, if you take a look at source number 2 on the sheets, this is a passage from the Talmud in a volume called Kiddushin, which talks about the mitzvah of educating one's children. And it says a father, and it's father specific, we'll talk about father versus mother later, but it says a father is obligated in these ways for his son, the following things have to be done for the child. Circumcise, redeem, which is the mitzvah of pidyon haben. I won't go into it right now, it's not directly relevant, but that's what redeeming refers to. To teach him Torah, to marry him off, and to teach him a trade. And some add to teach him how to swim. Those are the basic obligations, some of which we outsource to those who, let's say, know how to swim. Now, we have different ways of dealing with each of these. I do know how to swim. My father taught me how to swim. But there is some dispute. You notice here that it says one's son. Right? And some of these items clearly are male-specific. Circumcision is male-specific. However, what about teaching the child Torah? So there is some dispute on this front. However, both the Mishneh Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan, recent works of Jewish law, make clear their position that indeed the obligation in terms of education is for the daughter as well. So a father has, and again, we'll talk about the mother, but a father has a mitzvah, has a commandment of teaching their children Torah. On that basis, there may be a need for the father to have at least visitation, if not actual custody, in order to be able to fulfill the mitzvah. Already, Moshe.
Well, it says that actually the father, by hiring a teacher, teacher. It's the same thing as a college actually.
Right. So there's a lot of discussion about the ability to hire a teacher and whether that would take care of the responsibility, as well as the father's right to say, well, I don't want to hire a teacher. I actually would like to teach them personally. True. So you have this as one potential custody-affecting law. Another example of it is the fact that we have within Judaism multiple layers of responsibility for taking care of others, whether you mean the mitzvah of tzedakah, of philanthropy, whether you mean general chesed and kindness, restoring lost property to people, making sure not to stand by while somebody is being hurt. We have all these mitzvot of taking care of others, and they all begin in the home. My initial responsibility, my first responsibility, will be for my family members, and therefore I may have a duty of custody for that reason. There is also the element of concern for the spiritual well-being of others, right? Which is also known as minding other people's business. We have within Judaism various commandments that say that if I see somebody is doing something that is incorrect by Jewish law, I'm supposed to get involved and try to educate. Again, how you do that is complicated, but there is such a mitzvah. Certainly one will have that then for one's children. Now, none of these directly speak to custody, but these are principles which may come into play when you try to figure out who has custody. And one might expect, I would have expected, that from the sparseness of custody-specific material, the result would be a lot of confusion and dispute. But in truth, what it actually leads to is a fairly straightforward system of addressing custody issues with a lot of agreement. And the disputes are primarily in theoretical cases, like, well, what if someone would do this? Which, you know, realistically, in the great big world that we have, someone eventually will. But they're not the common cases. In the normal cases that come up, it's actually relatively straightforward. So, in terms of the philosophy of custody, when you go back to Roman law, why did a parent have custody? In Roman law. The father had control. More than control, the father had ownership. Children were property of the father. And so therefore, the father had custody, and it was a very simple and clean system. I expect that's not the way it works today. What's the principle beyond the only religion I'm going to deal with is Judaism. I'm not speaking to any other religion. But what is the doctrine, if you will, that's behind custody in regular civil courts here in Ontario? Sorry? Property? Best interest is the way we decide. But what's the idea behind it? Or is the idea behind it the child is an independent entity and this is what's best for the parents to have them? Is that what you're saying? Sorry? It's a child-focused approach. So it's all generated by the child. So in other words, that's what you're saying.
Generated by the authoritarian, paternalistic type system that determines what is best for the child at a certain times in our history, Great Britain, Canada, U.S., presumptions.
Right. Well, let me explain the Jewish way, and I think that will explain more what I'm getting at. Yeah.
I look at the custody as how do we keep a child not as a ward of the state, like it's not supported by the state, but charity at home.
Got it. Keeping charity at home. Okay. That's something I'm going to come back to. Yeah.
I'm surprised that you're using the phrase custody because the concept of custody means somebody is a custodian. And historically, like you said, Roman law, women and children were chattels possessed by the landlord, husband, father.
Right.
So why are you using the word custody? It could be used, there's other words for it. In fact, here in Ontario, we're moving away from that language significantly.
Right.
We don't call it custody.
Right.
We call it parenting.
Right. So the reason I'm using custody is twofold, because you are correct, certainly in the Roman context. But I'm using it for two reasons. One is because it's simply the most popular term that I hear people use when they discuss these issues. And the other is because it will actually suit very well the Jewish law perspective of it, which is what I'm going to be laying out. You see, Jewish law says it's not a right of the parent at all, but it's actually a duty of the parent. The parent has an obligation to take care of the child. It's not a choice that the parent has. I would like to exercise my right to have the child be in my home. But rather, it's the responsibility of the parent to serve as a custodian, to be somebody who is going to look after the needs of the child. And everything within the way that Jewish law looks at the management of the affairs of the child is based on that. It's an obligation for both parents. If you take a look at source number 4, I actually skipped number 3 by accident. Number 3 was a source that demonstrates the idea that one has to train both daughters and sons in terms of educating them in Judaism. But number 4 comes from Rabbi Moshe Trani, also known as the Mabit. I'm going to bring you, as you can see on the sheets, some 30 sources or so. We're going to be hopping around Jewish history. That's not a product of cherry-picking one source over another. What I tried to do is to show you the way that these issues were dealt with in the course of Jewish history, different places, different times, but it's actually remarkably consistent across space and time. So he writes the following. The statement, which is a Talmudic statement we're going to get to, but the statement that a daughter stays with her mother is not because the mother has greater closeness and love for her. Rather, it is for the benefit of the daughter, so that she will learn appropriate conduct from her. So we're going to see the Talmud state that the daughter should be raised by the mother. That's the default assumption. He says, it's not because the mother loves her and would be hurt if she didn't have the kid with her. It's not about the mother. It's about the daughter and a philosophy that thinks that the daughter will be better off if raised by the mother. That does not become an absolute rule. I'm going to come back to that principle. What I'm trying to show you with source number 4 is simply that it's framed not as the parent's interest, but rather the child's interest. And the same thing for the son. I brought you a case in source number 5 involving father and son. There is a principle, which we'll get to, that suggests that after the age of 6, the son is to be raised by the father. Again, not an absolute principle. We'll talk about that. But look at the comment from Rabbi Yechezkel Landau in 18th century Prague. Started out in Poland, ended up in Prague. He says, if the former husband and wife, right, they divorced, will not live in the same city after the divorce, the law is that the son should stay with the father, even when younger than 6, to train him and teach him. And the point that he's trying to make is that the father is needed in order to educate the child, and on that basis, we're going to give custody to the father, because the father is going to be the one who's going to educate the child. Again, it's for the sake of the child. The main distinction I want to draw between a philosophy that says that it's about the parent's right, I'm exercising my right to keep my child with me, as opposed to the parent's responsibility to look after the needs of the child, the main difference is that you can't back out so easily. You can't say, as a parent, well, I'm not interested in doing it, let the other one raise them. If, in fact, the determination is the child will be better off with you, then you have the responsibility to look after the child. And it has nothing to do with the parent's particular preference. So that's the idea. It does end up being a best interest philosophy. What you end up with is the belief of the law that it's best for this child to be with that particular parent at this time. Yes? Yeah.
Generally, the mitzvah of education starts at the age of 6.
Right.
So then, I don't see the truth, obviously, but how does he deal with that?
Right. So we're going to come back to that. Hold the question, because it will be relevant in the Magid Mishnah that he references at the end. It's just not relevant yet, which is why I skipped that point. So what creates the duty for the parent? If there is an obligation for the parent, which is what we're suggesting, what creates that responsibility? So for fathers, there is a direct obligation to support one's children. There's some discussion. There are those who contend that it goes with the ketubah. Remember that the ketubah, the marriage document, specifies all sorts of duties that the husband is going to have towards his wife, as well as for children that she has from her previous marriage. And within that, within this set of responsibilities to her, some suggest that includes a responsibility to support any children he has with her. What's the weakness in that argument on a practical level? If you're going to tell me that the basis for a father's obligation to support his child is is the ketubah that he has with his wife. Oh, you're gonna have a big problem. No, forget if the ketubah's gone. What if there is no ketubah? What if it's out of wedlock? Now there's no obligation anymore because there was no ketubah. I mean, that's what we would be suggesting, and that doesn't exist within Judaism. It's simply not true. And rather, it's a biological obligation that is pinned on the father rather than the mother, that he must support children he produces in a way that will be best for the children. That's the basic principle that's involved. Take a look at source number 6, please. This is one of the most important responsa in the discussion, both because it's authored by Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, also known as Rashba. It was originally attributed to Nachmanides Rambam, but that was a mistake. It was actually discovered to be his. And he is one of the giants of the development of Jewish law. That's one reason why this is important. Another reason is because it's relatively early in the train of written responsa that we rely on, and therefore it shapes a lot of what comes afterwards. And he writes, in describing the rules of custody, he says, the reason why we would assign a daughter to the mother is for the mother to guide the daughter, teaching her the way of women and keeping her from accustoming herself to lawlessness. But it is more appropriate, he says, for the son to be with male relatives. I'm not addressing right now the question of how you would apply this today. We're going to get to that. But that's the assumption that he's making. That's the assumption that the world made for a very long time. That the default is that the mother will guide the daughter in the ways of women. Translate that however you choose. The son will be better off with males. With male relatives who will accustom him and teach him the ways of study and of men more than the mother would. In every case, one must be careful in these matters to follow what the court determines will benefit the orphans in each case. The court is the parent of orphans charged with seeking their benefit. I'm going to come back to the latter part. That's going to be very relevant shortly. But his main thrust is, it's about the best interests of the child. And the court is responsible to determine what those best interests are. Not so different at all from what you see, I think, in the secular system today. The court acting as the parent of the children. My Latin pronunciation is terrible, so I'm going to mangle parens patriae. Is that something along those lines? Sorry, not in loco parentis. That's different. You said it. Parens patriae. Thank you. Got it. Well, very impressive. The I don't know if the recorder caught your Latin, but we can always dub it in later. But the idea here is, avi en shel yatamim, you are, the court is, the father of the orphans and responsible to look after them. However, when it comes to the mother, it's actually framed as optional, with one exception. The exception is if, by not doing this, she would endanger the health of the child. And they deal specifically with a case of nursing, where there is a child who is already attached to the woman who is nursing it, and then she decides, I don't want to nurse it anymore, and now it's hard to find somebody who can nurse the child and who the child will respond to. Take a look at source number 7. This is a passage out of the Talmud, which states, if a woman vows not to nurse her son, and she is divorced, he, the father, cannot force her to nurse. And if the child knows her, the father should pay her, meaning pay her to nurse, and compel her to nurse him to avert danger. So he can say to her, you have to do it. I'm going to have to pay you for it. He has to compensate her, whatever the going rate is. But ultimately, he has to do that, and then she will have to nurse, because it's a threat to the health of the child. But otherwise, it's actually the father who has the responsibility, rather than the mother. Yes?
Would that include daughters?
That would include daughters, correct. It's a fascinating thing that it's pinned on the father as his duty rather than on the mother, and it really is somewhat counterintuitive when you think of the historic roles of fathers and mothers. On the other hand, I very much like a society in which you compel the father to remain in the game. I think that there's a lot to be said for that. Well, that's the basic principle. that this is in fact a parental duty, and it's specifically a paternal duty as it's framed originally. The Talmud then divides up the roles among the parents, and this brings us back to the discussion about the six-year-old. So take a look at source number 8. Number 8 actually requires a little bit of explanation first. So one of the laws that one of the laws of Shabbat is the law of Tchum. And what the law of Tchum means is the following. Let's say I live in, I live in Thornhill. I am allowed to walk anywhere within the settled area in Thornhill on Shabbat. This has nothing to do with carrying. This is a completely different law. I am allowed to walk anywhere I want within that settled area on Shabbat. However, once I reach the end of the settled area, there is a limit to how far I'm allowed to travel on foot on Shabbat. It's up to approximately 1 kilometer outside of the area. The boundary is called Tchum. However, this is a fundamentally rabbinic rule, and they gave a rabbinic out to the rule that they created. And they said, you can extend a little further. In the event that you take a meal, take food, and leave it there before Shabbat begins, somewhere outside of town, within your kilometer or so distance, that meal is called an Eruv, then you can say, that's really my location for Shabbat, and now I have an additional kilometer beyond that. So if you have, for some reason, need to walk a little further on Shabbat, before Shabbat, you leave your meal out in that spot, and then that's your starting point, so to speak, and you can travel there and then a kilometer beyond on Shabbat itself. That's the rule. It's a fun discussion for another time, where this comes from, why we do it, and so on. But that's the rule. But here's the question. Children normally go with their parents in terms of the place that their parents have identified as their place for Shabbat. So if my father sets up his Erev meal outside of town, it's assumed that goes for me as well. But what if a kid has a father who set up his Erev meal on this side of town, on the west side of town, over there, and his mother set up her Erev meal on the east side of town? Where can the kid travel on Shabbat? You can't take both because they're inherently contradictory. You only get one. So how do you manage it? On this, the Talmud says, source number 8, a minor male who needs his mother goes with his mother's Eruv, it's called an Eruv Tchumen, meaning with the mother's and not with the father's, until the age of 6. Until the age of 6, he goes with the mother. Now again, as I said in the beginning, this has nothing to do with custody. What they're saying is, when the kid is so young that the kid needs the mother, so then he goes with the mother's Eruv, which by the way is the 6th birthday. Rabbi Yonah Reis, if you take a fast look on the last page, you'll see I gave you a bibliography of articles on this. They almost all of them are available online for free. There's also a book that's not. But the first several are English, and then there are 3 that are Hebrew, and then the last one is an audio lecture for Rabbi Yonah Reis. Rabbi Yonah Reis has a lot of experience dealing with this. He was the head of what's called the Beth Din of America, of the Rabbinical Council of America, based in New York. He was their head for years. Now he's actually the head of the Beth Din in Chicago. He has a recording on the topic of custody, which I found helpful in preparing this. But he comments that it's the 6th birthday, meaning when the child turns 6, that's when this ends. The sages took this as a statement that, generally speaking, the son goes with the mother until the age of 6. After that, over to the father to teach him, because the father has a mitzvah of educating him. Question comes up, what if the mother wants to keep him longer? What if the mother says, I want to keep him longer? Does she have the option of doing so? So take a look, please, at source number 9 from Rambam, or by Moses Maimonides. He writes in his work of law, when the child matures and is weaned, then if the divorced mother wishes for her son to be with her, notice it's up to her to choose, we do not separate him from her until he is fully 6 years old. We compel the father to support him with his mother. After 6 years, the father can say, if he's with me, then I will support him. If he's with his mother, I'll give him nothing. He says you can cut off support after the age of 6, assuming you're not getting custody. And the daughter stays with her mother forever, it doesn't mean literally forever, even after the age of six. So Maimonides believes she is able to opt out. Now, whether the father can really say, I am going to withhold support on that basis, is actually subject to great debate. There are two schools of thought. This is one of those areas where there is debate. One school of thought says, yes, his requirement to support is linked to his obligation to educate. In the event that the child isn't coming to him for education, he can say, well then, I wipe my hands. Whereas, there's a second view that says, no, what it's trying to say is that he's able to demand custody at that stage and say, I have an obligation to educate the child, and at that point, and he'll be able to hold support as a threat for it. Those are the two views. Yes? What do you mean? Yeah, no, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. Thank you. I didn't know that. Yes?
Quick question. So assuming the father's obligation to support the daughter, we're moving.
Correct. The father's obligation to support the daughter remains regardless. Now, I should note, I didn't want to discuss support overall, but I will note, the support threshold of until six is taken as a core biblical or quasi-biblical obligation. Rabbinically, the obligation to support the child extends beyond six as a function of tzedakah, as a function of my basic obligation to help people in need. Your own child comes first, and that goes until adulthood. How you define adulthood is actually subject to some debate. In Israel, I believe they decreed it to be somewhere around 18. I'm not sure precisely of what it was, but they said this is simply the law here for the rabbinical courts. They said that they're going to dictate it as 18. I've heard others say graduate school. I'm not sure exactly in which jurisdiction what they're actually doing. Yes? Interesting. First degree if they're not working. Okay. So there is actually some debate about this. This goes back to the question about chinuch, about educating the child. Because you're assuming then that until the age of six, the son is going to be raised by the mother. What happened to the father's obligation to educate the child? So Rabbi Avraham ben David is the classic commentator on the work of Maimonides. Ravid is the classic commentator of the work of Maimonides, and he says Maimonides is wrong. He says, no, the father is able to claim the son even before that because he has an obligation to educate the son. And some argue that Maimonides agrees with that. And that his only reason for saying it this way here is because he wasn't dealing with the laws of education. That's a separate discussion. However, Magid Mishnah, commenting on the Rambam, commenting on Maimonides, in source number 10, Rabbi Vidal of Toulouse, said the following, I have not found any educational duty for a child of 4 or 5. There's nothing you're obligated to teach the kid. One need not bring him to a teacher before 6. Well, then what was the objection from Rabbi Avraham ben David, from Ravid? Perhaps Ravid is referring to what Rambam recorded in the Laws of Torah Study, chapter 1, where he said, when he, the child, knows how to speak, his father teaches him, Moshe commanded us the Torah. In other words, you do teach very basic things to a child before the age of 6. But he says, if that's your objection, that's not a question. Even if the child is with the mother, the father can train the child occasionally when visiting. In other words, visitation will suffice for you to teach the kid whatever he needs before the age of 6. And that's the answer that he gives in order to resolve how it is that you can assign custody to the mother while the father has an obligation to educate. He says you don't need to have the child in your house in order to fulfill your duty at that stage. It's less intense at that stage. So what we've said is that until the age of 6, all kids are with the mother. That's essentially what emerges. After the age of 6, the son goes to the father. Further, take a look at source number 11. Number 11 is a passage in the Talmud that deals with the status of the daughter. It's a comment Talmudically on a Mishnah, on an earlier source, which I brought you in italics. The earlier source said the following. If a woman marries, on condition that her husband will feed her daughter from a prior marriage. Okay, meaning, a woman marries a man, and she says, I'm marrying you on condition that you'll take care of your stepdaughter, that you'll take care of my daughter who I'm bringing into the marriage. And then they are divorced. The husband cannot say, I will only support her, the daughter, when she lives with me. Meaning, you took her away from me. I'm not interested in supporting. He says, you can't do that. You accepted a responsibility. He must bring the food to the place where the girl's mother lives. That's the line in the Mishnah. Commenting on that, the Talmud says the following. Rav Chisda said, this wording teaches that the daughter stays with her mother, because it says you have to bring it to wherever the mother lives. But then they say maybe not. Perhaps this is only a minor. She lives with the mother because of a particular event, meaning there is a historical reason why we would leave the minor child with the mother. What was the historical event? It explains, for we have learned. If a man dies, leaving a young son with the boy's mother, and the father's heirs say the child should grow up with them, and the mother says her son should grow up with her, we leave him with his mother rather than with someone who could inherit from him. Because once this happened and his heirs slaughtered him on the eve of Rosh Hashanah. There are different versions of this story. One version is that it's the eve of Pesach. I don't know that that makes it any better. But the story that they're depicting here, this bizarre story, is that there was a child who was placed with people who stood to inherit if something were to happen to this child. And they actually killed the child in order to be able to inherit. And on that basis, he says, well, maybe the statement that the daughter goes to the mother is talking about a minor daughter, and we're putting her there because you want to shield her from anybody who would do her harm. Maybe it's not actually that we believe daughters always go with the mother. What if she's older? She won't necessarily. To which the Talmud concludes, no, that can't be. Because then it would have said to the place where she is, where the daughter is. Saying to the place where her mother lives teaches that the daughter stays with the mother, whether older or younger. Meaning, in conclusion on this passage, the daughter goes with the mother, and the reason for it is something we've already seen, but I'm bringing you source number 12, which is an early source that says it explicitly. Why do we want her to be with the mother? Because the mother is around the house more than the father, who goes to his work and business. And yes, I know this is anachronistic. This was the 13th, 14th century. It wasn't anachronistic then. While the mother watches her and teaches her tzniut, loosely translated as privacy and the way of women. But a son, because the father must teach him Torah and train him in mitzvah, must be with his father. So the idea is that she will train, the mother will train the daughter. So what we now have, let me try to sum up what we've said so far, is that parents should recognize a duty that they have, in particular the father, a duty that they have, and not treat it as a right. In particular, there's a concern about the education of the children in a Jewish lifestyle, each as is appropriate for them. There seems to be a preference for daughters to be with the mothers, and sons to be with the father. And one other note, and that'll wrap this section, and they'll take questions, but take a look at source number 13, because this is crucial. This is stated by Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook about 100 years ago, but it's been echoed by many down through the ages. I just liked his framing of it. He says, custody must be given to the court, meaning it is given to the court to decide, is what he's saying, based on the judge's perception, the situation of the parents, and general matters of life, and Judaism in particular. Which, as we're going to see, means you may have to be prepared to throw the rules out the window. Everything we've just said, daughter to the mother, boy to the father after six, and all that, depends on what you see in the particular case. It's not meant to be applied 100% across the board. Yes?
The original father.
Right. It's a good question. The case that's given to us doesn't say, but it really could be either way. It could be she's widowed and therefore he's not there, or it could be she's divorced and he doesn't have the means of support. Right? It could be either way. Yes?
I just find it a little strange that, I mean, I know it's taking a 20% perspective, but that this would be justified. I agree with the conclusion. I just think it's we know, we can now take all these steps. Like, I think the foundational example is...
What do you mean by because of stepdaughter?
Well,
where do we...
He's saying, like, in this day and age, you wouldn't say, oh, a stepdaughter will stay with her stepfather rather than stay with her mother if the parents get divorced, unless you have, like, really unusual circumstances. Like, it's not his natural daughter.
Right.
So why would somebody think that she should go and live with him if her own mother is alive? So sort of,
I didn't see that. Which source are you referring to?
Saying if a woman marries, because it says it teaches that the daughter stays with her mother. Well, I think that it's just odd.
Oh no, that's not what he. I see what you're saying. That's not what he's working from. He's working from the fact that this earlier source, this Mishnah, chose to frame its wording as you must take the food to where her mother lives. It's a choice of wording. It's not the ruling in the case. Yeah, but you're right. I looked at that and thought, also, why in the world would she want to do that? Not just in our day, but in their day also. Why would any? Why would that ever happen? Correct. Right. No, they're just working on the. They're working off of the choice of words. That's all. Motion.
Number 112.
Yeah.
Basically, these days, since the mothers and fathers are supposed to be.
We're going to get to these days.
Right.
We're not there yet.
Very close second. The other thing is, and we have family daughters that can come from the direct. But if a situation where somebody marries someone else, they've been divorced and married someone else who's also divorced, and they have children of their own. If they don't agree to, in other words, to take these children as their own, if they basically say they are your children, they can stay here, but I'm not taking adoptions, right? If they don't adopt, right, correct. If they don't do that, they have no responsibility for the child if these parents divorce. Mm-hmm. If they don't accept the child as their own or adopted, whatever it is. If they do, yes, an obligation to continue.
And I can understand why modern society has that, but in Judaism, classically, there were conditions of the ketubah that stipulated the rights and protections of children from a previous marriage. So that's our groundwork here. In terms of the Talmudic rules, in terms of some hints at best interest, now we move to our first question. Does the good of the, and this is really the main question, the others are easy once we get through this one, but does the good of the child override halachic rules of custody? These rules that we've just said, the under six, over six, male, female, what happens with best interest? So the role of the courts is traditionally understood to be to enforce the best interests of the child. Source number 14, I brought you just one example of a sign that appears several times Talmudically, which is the statement that the court is indeed the father of orphans. Father in the sense that, just like a father has the duty of taking care of the children, the court has the duty of taking care of anyone who doesn't have a protector. Because of that, the court will decide, we want this child to be placed with this parent and has the authority to do so. And one writer says, well, it's just like they guard the property of individuals who have no guardian. If somebody is incapacitated, is incapable of making decisions, so the court also steps in to look after their property. So too, they'll look after their person. Take a look at source number 15, please. This is a case that comes up in a variety of ways. Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, writing at this point, I think he was in Spain. In the 15th century, he left Spain in the expulsion in 1492. So the story goes as follows. Reuven and his wife divorced. Their 7-year-old daughter lives with her mother. The mother has, quote, strayed, and has birthed a child from this. Seeing this, Reuven wants to take his daughter from her, lest she learn from her mother. Right? Reuven is scandalized. He divorced this woman. Now, lo and behold, she's taken up with somebody out of wedlock. She's produced a child. What kind of values is this woman conveying to my daughter? How dare she? And I want custody for my daughter. Well, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra is sympathetic. He says, it is clear that Reuven is justified. For the sages said that a daughter should be with her mother because her mother's company is good for her. Here, we can testify her mother's company is not good for her. Even if she would say, I want to be with my mother, we would not listen to her. We're going to come back to that later. For we are concerned lest she be drawn after her mother, and certainly when she is already seven and tasting sexuality. The 15th century, today, actually, internet, I don't know. I'll leave that to you. More than this, I would say that even if her father, Reuben, were not alive, and other relatives would come to take her, right, take her away from the mother, we would listen to them. And not only this, but even without relatives, the court is the father of orphans, and they are obligated to take her from her mother and place her in the home of those who they see to be righteous. It is a logical extension of their duty to supervise orphans' property. If they are obligated to look after their property, certainly they must look out for the orphans themselves, lest they follow a wicked path. Now, I'm going to come back to the nuances of this case, because there's a lot to discuss here. I brought you the entire thing instead of just one line, because we're going to have to see this case multiple times. But the point is, the point that I wanted to draw from this right now, is they say, look, if we're supposed to look after property, we're clearly also supposed to look after the person themselves and make sure they're going to be all right. On that basis, rabbinical courts do look for the best interests of the child, and there are numerous responsa on this, going back to earliest Jewish law down till today. I brought you an early one from 11th to 12th century Spain. I'm not sure of the precise year. Rabbi Yosef Ibn Migash, also known as Rim Migash, he says, it would be appropriate not to allow this Reuven, who has come to him for custody, to take the daughter from her mother. She should remain with her mother as she has been from the start, unless we would see profit and benefit for the daughter in switching. He says, you first assume that the daughter is going to be with the mother. We're only going to change it if it's actually good for the daughter, in our opinion. That's the basic rule. And it's literally all over every decision on custody in modern rabbinical courts. One question that comes up, if you're going to tell me the court plays a role like this, that the court is actually responsible to look after the best interests of the child, what about if the child has two living parents who are married to each other, but the local rabbinical court thinks that they're being raised badly? Are they also responsible to look after the child? Do we extend this and say that they have the ability to go into the home and say, we're taking the child away because we believe that you're not treating the child, you're not raising the child properly? Not talking about an abuse case. That's its own discussion, right? We had a session on that in September. But not abuse of the child, but just we think that they're not raising the child properly. So the answer is that this is actually a debate. If you take a look at source number 17, Rabbeinu Asher, one of the key original, one of the key writers of Jewish law, says the following. He has a case. Reuven's wife died. You know, for anyone who's not familiar, Reuven is like John Doe. It's not that there was one guy named Reuven who was involved in all these cases. So Reuven's wife died, leaving behind a minor daughter. Reuven agreed with his father-in-law, Shimon, for Shimon to take all the assets which the daughter should inherit from her mother and support the daughter with food, drink, clothing, and suitable marriage. So Reuven and his wife were married. They had a daughter. The wife dies. Reuven's father-in-law says, I'll take over. Just give me her assets and I'll take over. Reuven is fine with that. But the daughter is not happy. The daughter wants out. May the daughter cancel the arrangement when she matures and claim her own, meaning claim her own assets, and say, I would like to do this myself. So on this, Rabbeinu Asher feels, well, take a look. He quotes you, this is a piece out of his answer, but it's the relevant piece for us. He quotes you a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud says, a completely different case. If a father wounds his child accidentally, you're not dealing again with an abuse discussion, something happened and by accident he wounds the child. Normally, if you wound somebody, you're obligated to pay them all sorts of damages in Jewish law. But if you give this kid, who's not yet old enough to manage his own affairs, if you give this kid the money, he's not going to spend it properly. So what you do is you create something that's called in the Talmud a sigula. Segula means something that will be essentially a trust, something that he will earn from later on, but that he won't something he will earn from later on, but that he won't be able to touch right now. That's the way you set it up. So he says the following. He says, the Talmud says, when it wounds his minor son should create this trust, and since it says he, the father, should create, and not they should create, which would have meant the court, we learn that a court does not manage the affairs of a minor if there is a father. Meaning, the court does not intervene. In the case that we're discussing, Reuven agreed that his father-in-law should be able to do this. The daughter has no complaint beyond, I like to manage things myself. Therefore, the father's decision stands, the court is not able to intervene. And there are various sources that support this. There are some who contend that that's actually not what Rabbeinu Asher meant. In source number 18, I brought you an opposing view, who says that actually what Rabbeinu Asher was trying to say in number 17 is simply that the father is responsible to act in a way that benefits the child, and if the court thinks the father made a good decision, then it will support it. So he disagrees with that read. But there is another view. Source number 19 is the son of Rabbeinu Asher who wrote 17. So source number 17, Rabbeinu Asher says, the court does not countermand what the father says. The court will honor what the father stipulated. Source number 19, Rabbeinu Yehuda, his son, says, that's not true, Dad. He says, it appears to me that where the father is not acting properly, the court is obligated to act to benefit the minor. He says they will actually overturn the action of a living, functioning, in full capacity father. That's how far they will go to protect the best interests of the child. Yes? Yeah? Correct. Right. So it's not actually that. Rather, the issue is that she's over the age of 12. She's reached maturity in that sense, but she is not yet of age in terms of managing financial affairs. She's not 18, basically 18 to 20. So that's the case. Good question. So best interest does, in general, override the rules. The question of whether it would override a living parent is a good question, but basically best interest will override the rules that we have defined. So, for example, I brought you a quote in number 20, Rabbi Shmuel de Medina. The English is on the top of the next side. He says, the general rule is that all of the rights the sages presented in saying the daughter is with the mother are not about taking away from others, meaning it's not about saying the mother gets and not the father. They spoke to help the daughter. It's not for the sake of the mother. As Rabbeinu Nissim, an earlier authority, wrote, and regarding the son, they spoke to help the son. In other words, it's always about the best interests of the child, and that's the extent to which we'll follow these rules. If it's not the best interest of the child, we will not follow these rules. There's more to say in this regard, but I'm gonna abbreviate a little bit here in the interest of getting to certain other points that we have to see. One note that I will show you is number 23. This is from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who writes the Ashkenazi section in our Code of Jewish Law, says, the daughter only goes with her mother if it appears to the court that being with her mother is good for her. But if it appears better to them for her to be with her father, the mother cannot force the daughter to live with her. So you can see a recognition that these hard and fast rules are not hard and fast. It's not always true that it's better to be one, to be with one, or better to be with the other. You can't make a rule like that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we throw the rules out the window altogether. In other words, you might just say, well, then why have rules in the first place? What's the advantage of having rules if we're going to ignore them on a case-by-case basis? So one view states, and this is what I brought you in source number 24, that the default is you follow the rules, and you'll only override them in a case of clear harm. I'm not going to read it inside, again, in the interest of time, but that's the message in number 24, is that you really will work with the rules unless you see something that's drastic, something that's just really bad. On the other hand, The flip side of that is source number 25, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, who we also saw in a different response some earlier, says absolutely not. He says the court does not need to know things are terrible. The court can ignore the rules and just look at the case at hand, and it is their option. And in fact, one of the articles that I noted in the bibliography at the end, the article from Rabbi Grossman, he writes that he has done some research on the practices of modern Jewish courts, and he says they tend to ignore the rules and to simply say best interest on a case-by-case basis, and they don't bother with the until age 6 and after age 6. They feel that it's simply not the best way to assess situations anymore. Okay, so here's the big question, which I'm surprised no one's called me on yet. What factors constitute best interests of the child? What will Jewish law recognize as the child's best interest? So, yes, physical safety is fairly clear. We already dealt with the case of the murderous heirs, right, and saying don't you know, put the child with the heirs if there's a threat from them. So that we understand. There is also, though, concern for spiritual best interests. We saw the case that we now have to come back to of the mother who had a child out of wedlock and the concern that this isn't a good role model for my daughter. Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra very clearly said that the father was correct. As a matter of fact, one modern writer, and I brought him in the bibliography as well, Professor Gilat, Professor Yisrael Tzvi Gilat, he's in the bibliography, is adamant that all the rabbinical courts which are working with best interests and who say that best interest is the same, whether it's in a secular court or in a Jewish court, he says they're all wrong. And they're all disloyal to the system of Jewish law. He's sort of the voice in the wilderness on this. He quotes everybody else and says, and you're wrong, and you're wrong, and you're wrong, down the line. He says, the primary factor in best interest is religion. That's his argument. He says there's an obligation to educate the child in Torah. There's an obligation to educate the child in mitzvot, to practice Judaism. He notes that we have a principle of afrushe me'isura, which means that Jewish law requires that the court itself act to keep people from sinning. And he says, therefore, you know what courts are supposed to do? They should look at the two parents and ask themselves, which of these parents has better odds of educating the child to grow up to be a practicing Jew? And that's the one who should get the child. That's his argument. Yes?
In a couple of cases, actually, in the last 2 years,
yeah,
that the both the religious parents, they divorced, and one parent took them religious. They started not eating kosher and everything else.
Okay.
The case is one in England, there's in Toronto, two or three cases. Is this the same type of thing?
That's what he's arguing. He's arguing that you would actually take away custody. I have to say that I've looked through quite a few decisions, and I have yet to find any of them which mention that as a factor. That's not to say it doesn't exist, but I looked, and I looked for it, and I used searchable databases and so on, and I still couldn't find any case in which they actually said we must keep the child from sinning, and therefore, could it be a subtext going on in certain cases? Without a doubt. But I didn't see it in any decisions. But I did want to note for you, if you flip the page, source number 27, I saw this very interesting footnote in Professor Pollack's work, Contrasts in American and Jewish Law. He quotes Rabbi Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg. Rabbi Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg is a leading rabbi in Israel today, head of a major rabbinical court. And he says, according to Rabbi Goldberg, education in ethical matters and personal qualities takes precedence over teaching Torah ways. He based his opinion on the sages of the Musar school, who taught that edification in proper ethics and personal qualities supersedes all other education, not least because only through proper character development can the other aspects of education, such as Torah study and professional training, be acquired and applied properly. So first make sure you put the child with a parent who's going to make the child a good human being, before you worry about who's going to send the child to the best school where they're going to pick up the most material. So I thought that was an interesting point coming from a very responsible person in the realm of Jewish law. So best interest of the child is clearly encompassing physical. There's no question, we saw in Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, there is a religious component to it. However, despite Professor Gilat's protests, I haven't seen courts actually decide anything on that basis. In a case of unfitness, where the court says the child should be going to the father, but we think that the father is unfit, or to the mother, and the mother is unfit, the default clearly is the other parent. That's found in source after source after source. And other relatives will have priority over strangers. So in the event that it can't be the father, it can't be the mother, then it will go to the grandparents. It will work its way around the family, always working from the best interest principle. There's a lot to be said on the legal theory that gives the power to the other relatives, but I'm not going to go into that right now. So what we've seen then is we do work with best interests. There's debate as to how egregious the violation of the child's interest has to be in order to override the basic rules. Do we say, always throw the rules out the window, or do we say, only if there's something terrible that we have to stop? The general practice is indeed to throw the rules out the window and just say, look at best interests of the child in a case-by-case basis. And the best interest is physical as well as spiritual. Now we get to the last few questions, which are really fairly quick. First, do we consider the child's preference? The child says, I want to be with daddy, I want to be with mommy. How much weight do we give to that? So it's really interesting. In the rest of Jewish law, minors have no say. They don't have the ability to execute contracts, they don't have the ability to engage in transactions, and they don't really have much to say. We dealt with this in one of my classes for doctors. We talked about the case in which a child says, I would like to donate bone marrow, I would like to donate an organ. And the general rule, with one potential exception, is we don't allow the child to make such a donation. There is a possible exception where it's for a sibling and the child is old enough to understand, because there are extenuating circumstances involved in that calculation. But generally not. Nonetheless, as we're about to see, case after case illustrates that we do consider the views of minors as very important in calculating what the custody decision ought to be. We work with minors down to the age of 6, as you're going to see. And the question is why. So there's a writer named Eliav Shochatman, whose work is found in the bibliography, who argues that the reason is because where the actor is performing a legal act, and the legal basis for the act being valid includes the party's volition. I want to do this. So a child is not able to say, I want to do this, and have it mean something in that sense. However, when the court wants to do something and it needs to know, is the child along for it, up for this or not? Is the child going along with it? Then yes, this is a matter of determining what a child wants. It's finding out reality. It's not a matter of the child executing something. And that's the difference, and that's why, he says, Jewish law will accept the word of the child. If you take a look at source number 28, a judge on a prominent rabbinical court in Israel said, the child is the litigant regarding arrangements made for him at the time of divorce. And he is the litigant after the divorce. He and no other. So you have to know what the child wants. That's not the same thing, I think, as what Professor Shochatman is saying. But that's his argument. He says the child is the one who's involved. It's his interests that have to be served. You don't like this idea?
I have a major problem with it, because great. There's so many cases here and anywhere else, the child is alienated by one parent against the other.
We're going to talk about that.
So
hang in there.
How can you use this example?
Hang in there. We'll get to that. It's a good question. Just hold on. The general rule is that we do listen to the child. There are all sorts of examples you can bring for this. Sources that are old, sources that are new. The child is indeed consulted on it. And not only that, even a minor child is consulted. I brought you source number 29. Rabbi Meir Katzenellenbogen, also known as the Maharam Padua, rabbi in Padua, Italy in the 16th century, dealt with a case involving two children. One was 11 years old, and one was much younger. And he said, one who reads Rashi Ketuvot, Rashi on the Talmud, carefully, could argue in favor of Mar Yehuda, who's the one who's making the claim for custody. Rashi there says, if a daughter is supported by brothers, we feed her in her mother's house, and we do not compel her to live with them. In other words, they're with the father, she's with the mother, she's being supported by them out of the estate they're managing. We don't say that she has to go live with them. we learn from here that if she would wish to be with her mother, we would not compel her to be with the brothers. And that's his main point. There is no compulsion. You don't say, you have to be with this one. If she says, I don't want to, then we're not going to force her to go with them. That might be a case of adult brothers, by the way. But that's one example. Take a look at number 30, which is the one that I really want, because it's the one that's with a six-year-old. Rabbi Moshe Alshich, in the 16th century, invokes the Jewish law principle called pi'utot. Oh, not ha-pi'utot. What that means is an age range that runs from 6 until the age of 12 for a girl or 13 for a boy. And it's an age in which, if you think of the mature minor doctrine, we say that if children demonstrate an understanding of what they're doing, then we take their words seriously. That's this age range. So he says, I say that if a minor, who is already 6 and up, says he prefers his mother's company, the guardian is not empowered to prevent this. Granted that they said regarding pi'utot that from age 6 their commerce is valid only the absence of a guardian, that's limited to property. That's when you're dealing with financial assets. Where there is concern that he might squander his assets. Regarding his person, the guardian lacks the power to compel him. So nobody can tell him you have to be with so-and-so. From the age of 6, we are already going to accept the word of the child. Now, I thought that I had brought a source on here. I see that I didn't. But to address Moshe's question, all of the literature that deals with this takes pains to mention that, oh, you know what, it's in 31 on a different point. Don't worry about it. We'll get to it in 31. But all of those who write on this say that it's the responsibility of the judges on the court to interview the child in such a way that they can determine that this is not the influence of a particular parent. That, you know, the word in Hebrew, in modern Hebrew for this, is shtifat moach. Hebrew speakers, what is shtifat moach? Brainwashing. Literally, brain flooding. The brainwashing. So they do talk about it. They are aware of the concern, and they contend with it. But the general principle is that we do listen to the child, even the child at the age of 6. However, go back again to that case of the child who's with the mother, and the mother has a child out of wedlock, where they said, even if she says, I want to be with the mother, we're not going to listen to her. Where the court says, we heard what you have to say. However, we believe that it's not in your best interest, then only if they're certain, and they really have to be certain, but if they are, then the determination is, we will not listen to the child's preference. So the court has the ability to override it, but they are responsible to take it into very serious consideration. Clear? Okay. Will a rabbinical court consult psychologists? So the reason I went into this one is because there's a stereotype that suggests that rabbinical courts are suspicious of modern science and have no interest in what medicine has to say, and God forbid to use technology. It's simply not true. So I brought you just a couple of examples. One, Rabbi Gedalia Felder, who of course was a leading rabbi in Toronto in the previous generation, says in a case that he's dealing with, the father asks for his son to be given into his custody. And the psychologist says the good of the child requires that he stay with his mother, to whom he is attached. And he has not yet developed properly. There's some kind of a developmental issue in this case as well. It can be seen that this is the true desire of the child. This, meaning to be with the mother, is the true desire of the child, and not only the fruit of his mother's persuasion. And on that basis, he says the child goes with the mother. And he is explicit that we rely on the psychologist. Ditto in source number 32, Professor Yechiel Kaplan, who provides a footnote with many resources to support this. He says, the experts establish their position based on contemporary views which result from research in behavioral science. The significance which judges assign to the view of these experts is quite visible in their decisions. In his study of the literature of rabbinical courts, he says, yes, they talk to the experts, they talk to the doctors, and don't just say, well, it looks to me like whatever. They have to be responsible about it. Rabbi Reese, in the audio lecture that I mentioned, at 1 hour and 9 minutes of the lecture, I noted it to be sure that I could go back to it, says that this was recorded when he was running the Beth Din of America out of New York. He says, we will not make a custody decision in our courts without consulting with a psychologist. It's simply part of the protocol. Okay, last item. Is a custodial parent allowed to relocate away from the other parent? So the most clear basis for visitation rights is the father saying, I have to be able to teach the child, like we talked about before. And saying that in order to teach him properly, or teach her properly for that matter, I need to have access to the child. The separate justification, though, is this is the best interest of the child. The child will do better when the child has the parent around. If you flip to 34, I'm jumping 33, but if you take a look at 34, again from Rabbi Felder, although the children are legally assigned to the father or mother, the other parent has the right to visit the children on an appropriate schedule, established by the sides or the court, assuming it benefits the child or his education. It's a given that best interests dictate that you allow for visitation as it's determined to be appropriate. And that's for the father as well as for the reciprocal rights for the mother. And there are many other sources, again, that support this. So what emerges from that is that visitation rights are recognized, and therefore, I realize now what I skipped in 33, I probably shouldn't have skipped. The Mabit, Rabbi Moshe Trani, back in 33, dealt with a case in which the custodial parent wanted to relocate away, and his statement was that you can't do it. Because you will, in the case he was dealing with, it will be the child who moved away from the father, and the father has the obligation to educate and will no longer be able to do so, and therefore he says you're not allowed to move away, thwarting the ability of the father to carry out his duty. So I hope that this was somewhat clear. I hope I didn't rush through it too quickly. Are there any questions? Yes.
Very intrigued by about the rabbi there raising the point, leaving Israel for outside of Israel.
Yes.
There are, I'm aware of a lot of the customs that the spouse wants to leave Eretz Israel, the one wants to remain, the one that decides. Now, applying to children here, I'm wondering to what extent. He's 18 in Eretz Israel, looks upon the factor taking the child, the parent, in Eretz Israel. What influence that might have on decisions?
Right. So the answer in brief is he does mention it as a factor, but he mentions it as one of five or six factors. I didn't even bring you all the factors that he considers, but I did note here he mentions that it's dangerous to travel. He mentions being taken away from the other parent. There are other factors that he mentions. I don't think anybody, and I have not seen anybody in any decisions, would use that factor as the sole determinant in a case. It may be considered a part of a calculation of best interests of the child, that you may see, but not beyond that. Now, I should note, because I haven't said this yet, and I really need to, because not everyone is aware, when I keep quoting rabbinical courts in Israel, there's a distinction between rabbinical courts and then the secular court system. The secular court system does things entirely on its own, and sometimes in ways that are diametrically opposite. Even though both preach best interests of the child, their definition of best interest will be different. Just to note that. But what I've seen in the rabbinic decisions has not been to use that as a sole factor for anything.
Concerning the secular courts, Israel famously happens to be a family law lawyer.
Okay.
And I was asking her about what laws does the secular court apply. And she said actually they apply Torah and medical law, but they're exceptional.
Yes, and that's what you see.
Different than a religious court, they decide, but they're supposedly applying the religious law.
So it is true that you very often you see them quote particular sources from Torah as part of their decision, and yes, they will often take it in their own direction. That's true. Yes, and then. Just to know for anyone who came in late, if you didn't sign in, the sign-in sheets are on this table before you go. Yeah.
Say that the halacha was moving away from a presumption system of the under six boy girls. Is it moving away, or was the lesson just always intrinsic to it? The reason why I ask that is because in our world, family law, we have the pendulum. There's always that force that we want to have a presumption of pulling custody of shared parenting. Right, the idea of presumption.
would buy it. I'm just wondering if the Jewish law has moved to completely away from the presumption, or if it was always intrinsic that there'd be some presumption, but then you'd be able to.
Right. So this is a debate, meaning there are those who argue the rules were always meant just as generalizations of best interest, and then there are those who argue that no, best interest is what's coming in after the fact, and then they may view it as something that swings and could potentially swing back as a reaction to something. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Is there any recorded situation of divorce? The laws of divorce are presented, but an actual case, not that I can recall. Right, but that's not. It's pre-Sinai. There's no divorce going on. Yes, when Hagar, Hagar the mother of Ishmael is in the house, and then she has her son who is a threat to the other son, to Isaac, right? The story there of no, she's not a Pelegis. She's explicitly stated as a full wife. Yes, but again, it's pre-Sinai. You have no. You have the laws of marriage and divorce are given as part of the package of Torah law. They don't have that. So I wouldn't use that as a case.
Okay. My question otherwise was, we use the word best interest when we talked in the last hour about you've got it in Hungarian Canadian law. But I guess my question is, if it's under halakha, must be an act of support, is it really best interest or is it Jewish interest? Because we've had a clash, you mentioned earlier,
So from a halachic perspective, best interest has the physical component and the spiritual component, but they will not be divided from each other. What would happen if you felt that a child is not going to develop in a healthy way physically in a home where they'll get good spiritual guidance? We would take them out. Meaning that there is always within Judaism this declaration that life comes first, and that will always be a value. That goes back to the abuse discussion that we had in the class in September. But you're right that there will be that distinction in the secular courts. I saw a case. This case really bothered me in the secular courts in Israel. The father and a mother. The father was not Jewish. He was in Israel working for a UN force of some kind. And he was from Sweden, and he met an Israeli woman, and they fell in love, they got married, and they had a child. Then they divorced.
Where were they married?
In Israel. Whether they're married civilly, not civilly, they went to Cyprus, I don't know. They're not married under Jewish law. I don't know how they got married. I don't think that's correct. Right, I think that, and the point isn't that doesn't figure into their decision. They get divorced, the father goes back to Sweden, the mother stays in Israel and retains custody of the children. The mother takes her own life at some point in the next few years. I don't remember the full chronology of it. And the father says, I want the child to come live with me in Sweden. The mother's parents say, the child's been raised here, the child's been in a religious school, he's an Israeli Jewish kid, we're not sending him to Sweden. And the case comes before the Israeli court to figure out what to do. And the Israeli court says, better to send him to Sweden to be with his father. And when one of the arguments that's made is the best interests of the child himself is saying, I am a Jew, I want to stay in Israel and grow up that way. And the response of the court is, yeah, because that's what they tell him in school, and therefore that's what he thinks he wants. But that's not really his interest. I found that upsetting. I'm not the professional on this, but I don't understand why you can write it off because it comes from his education. And that's why we send kids to school. So that was, you know, sorry. I mean, should it take precedence?
I think that's an area that we can discuss, but contemporary education, I think the gentleman is raised at that point where, I mean, how do you determine what the child, how the child is educated and what...
Right. Well, I'll ask you a question then that that somebody asked me. The following question was put to me, and I didn't know what to say. But I had the impression the person who was speaking to me was actually giving me a real-life case. He's somebody who deals in these matters. The story was the following. There's a family in Brooklyn, an observant, I think even Hasidic family, trying to adopt for years. They work with what they think is a legitimate adoption agency. Finally, they get a child who's from Venezuela, Argentina, I forget exactly which country, and they start raising the child as their own. Child is now 7 or 8 years old. They raise him from infancy. And then they find out the adoption agency was not legitimate. The child had been kidnapped. The biological parents thought that the child was dead. They mourned for their child. This is a good Catholic family. And they thought they had lost the child. Now they find out their child is alive and is being raised as a chassid in Brooklyn. And now the question is, what do you do with this child? The parents, biological parents, want the child back. The parents who have raised him and who did nothing wrong, they thought they were doing everything by the book, have raised the child lovingly, given the child proper education for the last 7 years. The child thinks he's a chassid. He doesn't know of any life anywhere else and doesn't know anything. So the question is, what do you do with this child?
So what's the best?
I don't know. He left it for me as a thought problem. I've been thinking. But how do you define best interest? You're saying biology. And the kid who's in Israel, are you going to send to Sweden?
That's the Holocaust question. When the kids were sent to the monastery, they were raised.
I mean, these are difficult. These are difficult. All right. I'm going to call it here. But thank you very much. And I'm going to send out an email afterwards, God willing, with a link to the recording. And if there are any questions, you can follow up with me by email. Thank you.